This is one of those contests that I wish I could win because it seems really cool. You could win a trip to see the Eagles at the Sphere Las Vegas, this iconic band, this brand new iconic venue. 12 shows this September 20th through November 9th. You could be there. You need this keyword to enter to get a chance to win this. And the keyword for today is Eagles. We've got two trips for two with flights, a stay at the Venetian Resort Las Vegas, dinner, two tickets to the show, plus a VIP experience package. So your code word is Eagles. To enter for your chance to win, text that to 95819 and good luck. All right, switching gears, the U.S. Supreme Court released a ruling on tax law, Moore versus United States. This happened on Thursday, and it explored the scope of income taxes constitutionally allowable under the 16th Amendment. And the question before the court was whether these plaintiffs, Charles and Kathleen Moore, could be taxed on income earned by an Indian business in which they had a partial stake. To break it down, we have Chris Alberta, president of Principium Tactical Wealth Management, on the line. And Chris, you're always so good at explaining it to a T. So good morning.
Hi, Jamie. How's the crew this morning?
We're good. We're excited to talk about tax law here at 650. What does it mean that this ruling was 7-2 and it favored the government?
Well, I don't know what it means yet, and I don't think that anyone's going to know what it means for quite some time. It's a really fascinating story in many ways because it's just nebulous enough where both the conservatives are arguing against themselves. There's a lot of contradictions, and the more liberal people in terms of tax policy are saying many of the same things. No one quite knows what this means other than essentially had the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Moors, there probably would have been a very sudden headlong process by Congress into then redefining what the word income actually means and whether or not this is relevant to all tax policy, probably having to then quickly redefine a solid third of the tax code. So in many ways, unless you have a crystal ball, for example, no one's going to know what this means other than at least temporarily the tax policy that went in force in 17 to in many ways discourage foreign business investment and from companies that are benefiting from that, which really, you guys, is a fractional amount of the American investor populace. It's not really going to change much of anything. In fact, it's probably a win for the conservative-minded taxpayer in the sense that they're not going to now suddenly try to redefine everything.
Chris, how might this ruling influence investment decisions and the flow of capital between the U.S. and foreign markets, especially considering the financial implications for the shareholders?
Well,
like the Moors.
Yeah, maybe a bit of an infinite regress. I think that such a fractional amount of people in the United States have after-tax money, money that is living outside of an IRA type of account to invest in something like this, that it's the extraordinary minority. But what's often misunderstood, you guys, in this environment is that if I take $100,000 and I invest it in a stock, let's say take Apple or Microsoft or something that has just, you know, wildly gone up, I only pay tax in terms of a capital gain on the amount that it appreciated by if I redeem it, if I what's called realize it. That's how we often say things is, well, that's just a gain on paper unless I actually cash the stock out. But you know what happens if I die and leave it to my spouse or my kids? Nothing. No one pays any tax on it at all. It's called a step up in basis. It's probably the biggest break in the tax code. So, you know, in a scenario where we have $36 trillion of debt, and the country is desperate for money, and little over half of the people in the U.S. pay no income tax at all, based on their income levels and itemized deductions, so on and so forth. It's kind of a fascinating problem that we have. And on one hand, everyone should pay to some degree their fair share. But this is one of those arguments where the liberals have been saying, look, the rich aren't paying any taxes on any of this stuff. And this is such a small potatoes case, but it represents what could be just this completely outsized example. So if I was someone who was afraid of potentially paying tax on unrealized gain, I would want to stay away from these foreign investments that were kind of itemized into that 2017 tax bill. For everybody else, it doesn't really mean anything at the time being. If you have money outside of an IRA, you can still throw it in something that might appreciate, and you'll only pay tax on what you extract and actually put in your bank account.
Good to know, because I got to tell you, you and I both know that Senator Elizabeth Warren and some of her minions would love to get her hands on unrealized gains and have been talking about wealth taxes for probably the last 2 years now. And I know they would probably set a ceiling and say no one with a net worth under this amount would be taxed, but they're still looking to exploit that. So you're right. We'll have to see whether this cracks the door open. I wanted to get your read on something else. Story came out that said that for the first time, Gen Xers now have more money in their 401ks than their boomer counterparts. And this notion that they're not prepared for retirement may be a myth. But I wanted your take on that, because just because they have as much money as the boomers doesn't mean necessarily that 10 years from now that'll be enough when they retire.
Yeah, you know, I think that report is a little bit skewed, because they don't actually have as much money as boomers in terms of dollars and cents. They are ahead at that stage in their life on a percentage basis of where the boomers were. And what's interesting, too, is if you think about the average Gen Xer, probably in the 30 to 45 range, most of them entered the workplace in the 401k era, where someone was, you know, asking them essentially to methodically, systematically contribute every 2 weeks when they get paid. And the market, in a general sense, has basically done nothing but gone up since post-08. I mean, we had snafus with COVID in 2022. But on the whole, the thing has just raged upward, hitting record highs every couple of years. So it certainly is not something that is the same as a boomer who didn't even have a 401k really until the early 90s. So I'm not sure that that's really the fairest way to look at it, but I don't know that they're unprepared. I think many of them lived through with their parents a 2008 crisis that shaped the way they looked at saving.
Chris Alberta, president of Principia Tactical Wealth Management, thank you for your time this morning.
You got it. I'll see you guys soon.